So in story time, you know, we kind of get rid of just the X and O stuff and kind of get guys to talk about their story a little bit. So, you know, I know your father, of course, played in the CFL for Ottawa. So was football, like, in your blood right from a young age?
Yeah, it was. My dad used to take me into the dressing room at Lansdowne Park, and I used to, you know, fool around in the dressing room there with the other players' kids. And Whit Tucker and my dad were pretty tight, and we used to go over to their house all the time. They had a pool in the backyard, and... You know, it was, yeah, it was pretty idyllic in the beginning anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, you get to see what it takes to be a professional athlete pretty young. But, you know, I'm wondering, why did he play on the offensive side of the ball and you were more on the defensive side of the ball?
Well, you know, I don't know how many people know this about me, but I was born with a nerve defect in both ears. It's a congenital nerve defect. This means that the nerves that connect my, basically the ear, inner ear organs to my brain, is not fully formed. So it's a wonderful attribute to have when your wife is really angry with you and she wants to give you the 2 cents, but not so good if you got to hear a fire alarm or pay attention in school. So it's just something that I kind of worked through as a kid. I had some pretty interesting adventures first going to school. My dad played for Ottawa for 7 years. He was a tight end there, and he won 2 Grey Cups in 68 and 69. He was released halfway through the 1970 season as he was their very first players rep for their union, the CFLPA. Him and Jack Gotta weren't really seeing eye to eye at that point. So about 6 games, 7 games in, he was released. And so he came, a buddy of his called him up from Chicago and asked him if he'd be interested in working for him down there. And so he moved from Ottawa to a place called Elgin, which is, I think, west of Chicago. And so he was working in the warehouse, and that's basically the first time I think I ever went to school. And so they took me out of the neighborhood and put me in this residential school, which was a school for kids that had disabilities. We had deaf kids there, blind kids, kids with cerebral palsy, spinal bifida, you name it, it was there. And that was my first experience at school. It terrified me. You know, I used to urinate in my pants on my way home from school because I was so terrified by the things I'd seen. I didn't understand it because I didn't learn how to talk until I was about 5 years old. I got fitted with my first hearing aids at Northwestern in Chicago there, and the first hearing aid I ever wore came on what looked like a bra. I had to wear it over my shirt, and it was a box with the cord coming out of it. It's an earpiece in my ear. And the first thing I did when I got home was run down and found the biggest puddle I could find, and I dove into it and broke it. So my mom and dad had to take me back in, and they tried an over-the-ear hearing aid, the one with the earpiece and just a little thing over the ear, and I was a little bit more willing to wear that than I was with the other one. So, but a long story short, yeah, it's been tough. It's been a long road. We ended up moving back to Canada after a year because our job didn't pan out. My dad had a really hard time with not having the accolades after football was over, and my mom and dad split up, and we moved to Pembroke for a little bit, Ontario, right outside of Petawawa there. And then my mom and dad split up, and we moved in with my mom's parents in Tennessee. Where we moved in Tennessee was Oak Ridge, which is outside of Knoxville there. They developed the or enriched the uranium and plutonium there for 2 of the 3 atomic bombs that they built for World War II. They only ended up using 2 of them, but... The reason why that's relevant is because Union Carbide had taken over those plants by then in the early 70s, and there was a lot of really intelligent people from all around the world. I went to school, elementary school, with the kids of, you know, scientists and physicists from all over the world, and so they placed a high emphasis on education. So the school we were in was a very progressive school. We had an audiologist, a speech therapist, and all that. I had that all available there, and that's the only reason I ever ended up talking the way I do right now. They really pushed... I remember sitting down with a speech therapist, and she used to have a big bowl of M&Ms. I'd like Smarties better, but they didn't sell them down there in the South, so M&Ms were a close second. She would give me an M&M every time I said something the right way. I had a really hard time with my S's, my CH's, and FH's, and I remember it vividly. It was a really, really long. By the time I started that in grade 1, grade 2, and by the time I got to grade 6, I had caught up to my classmates. So it was really a lot of hard work, and I was very fortunate, just fortunate, because it was, if I'd lived anywhere else besides that particular part of the country, I don't think I would have improved the way I did. So, and in football, I guess you asked me in the beginning, this is a roundabout way of answering your question, because my mom and dad split up, football is king in the South. So, you know, that was a big thing. And my mom was really protective of me. She would only let me play soccer because there's no contact in it.
Yeah.
And I could wear my hearing aid. And then we lost every game. I think I played 2 years. We lost every single game. And I got really frustrated and fed up with losing. So I begged my mom, and she finally found a team that had that already had a kid with a hearing disability on it. And they had a rule on that team. You weren't allowed to talk in the huddle. You could only use hand signals. And so we did that. And we were really good. We won every game for like 2 or 3 years. And that's kind of when, you know, football kind of, in a way, it's been really kind of a Cinderella story when you look at it. You know, I mean, it's just a whole bunch of things, the configuration of events that just sort of came together and kind of pushed me on my way. So that's when I was about grade four, grade five. And then we moved again. My mom got promoted. We moved out to Colorado Springs, and I went to junior high and high school, and then ended up going to the University of Northern Colorado. I actually walked on there.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that. Jed Roberts joining us in story time, because I don't, you know, a lot of people, oh, you know what, hey, went to a pretty big college, but you were a walk on, you know, you didn't have a scholarship. When you walk on, like, do you just put your name on a list and show up for practice? How does it work to become a walk on?
Well, it's kind of weird, because I was running track, and I was actually the third best track triple jumper in the state of Colorado my senior year, and pretty good long jumper too. So, and I ran the sprints, and that was like 130 pounds ago. But they gave me a track scholarship. They offered me one, and they said, yeah, you know, you can run track for us at the University of Northern Colorado. So I went there, and I did some indoor track, and I didn't really like to. I wasn't really all that fond of running, and if you're not fond of running, track is not the sport for you. So I asked the coaches there if I could walk on, and they said yeah. My high school coach and I didn't really see eye to eye. He didn't think I could play because of the hearing thing, and back then I was only wearing one hearing aid, and I only wore one hearing aid when I came to Edmonton. And I think it was 1991 when I finally started wearing two, which I look back now and I'm astounded that I was able to make the progress I did just wearing one hearing aid, because now I know what I missed out on. A lot of people thought I was arrogant. Well, I was arrogant, but more arrogant than I really was, because they would say hi and I wouldn't hear them, you know, walking down the hallway. So it was really bad. So the track thing kind of was an in. When you walk on down there, it's really odd. It's not like they say, okay, you're a walk-on. You just kind of know that you're not going to play. Like, you just get beat up on your freshman year. You redshirt. They ended up, after my first year, offering me a scholarship, like a partial scholarship, and I quit track, and then that was it. You know, I just kind of stayed there. I was on the football team for 5 years. I traveled my first year, shared time with two starters. And yeah, it was a great, great time. I would recommend it to anybody. It was a lot of fun.
I want to get back to, you know, to being a walk-on in college. You got there as a track guy. So then did you have to go and ask the coach, or did the coach come to you, see you running track, and say, hey, I think you're pretty good?
Well, I think I kind of had an agreement in place where I would run track, and then I would go to spring ball and as a walk-on. I think I went in, and that was part of the deal. And I think the track guys, I don't think I told the track people I was going to do that. I think they assumed I was there full-time on track scholarship, and I just kind of through the back door. Like, I didn't want to give up on football, right, because my dad was such a prominent figure in my life and a big role model. And so I was just going to see what happens, right? So I went out for spring football, and obviously they saw something. And, I mean, I went into ball camp. My bad. I'm mixing up the years. I went into ball camp as a walk-on. And after that, they didn't really talk to me. It's really weird. Like, I know I've mentioned this before, but they don't really say anything to you. You just sort of kind of, if they don't get rid of you, then you just assume that you're part of the team. So that first year was really, really hard. Didn't really get any feedback or anything, unless it was from the guys that I was playing with. And the older guys, so I had to ask them a lot of questions. Like, how do you know if you're a walk-on? He said, well, if you're still around, then you're a walk-on, you know? So after that fall camp, the spring camp rolled around, and I kind of quit track, and I devoted full-time to freaking, and I got a scholarship offer after that spring camp. That's how it went down. And then every year they sort of increased how much they gave me until toward the end of there I was making a full ride. So it was definitely the hard way. Like, I've never gone anywhere and played football where I was like the big star and everybody knew who I was. It was never like that for me. I always kind of came in through the back door, and So it kind of went up the hard way, which made me appreciate it a lot more. I'll tell you that, you know. So I left the University of Northern Colorado. My last season there was 1989. My dad was in touch with Bob Ackles. He used to be the BC Lions GM, and he was working for the Dallas Cowboys. And he had we had an agreement where I was going to go try out for the Cowboys. We had an offensive coordinator on our staff at the University of Northern Colorado where I played, who was the former Montreal Alouettes head coach. His name was Kay Dalton.
Yeah,
and I didn't even know that he was the head coach at Montreal. I knew he'd been around and been coaching the NFL all over in the NCAA, but I didn't realize he'd been up in the CFL. Well, him and my dad got to talking, and my dad kind of let it slip that I was born in Canada, and he just about, Kay Dalton almost jumped through the phone and said, "What? Let me call the guys in the CFL. We need to get him up there." So I came into the league in the CFL in 1990 as an American, and then they challenged the league's decision. It's not like now where if your mom had a cup of coffee in Canada, you could be considered a Canadian. You had to prove that you were born there, you know what I mean? So I was born there, moved away after 5.5 years, and that was just under the window. If you spent 5 of the first 15 years of your life there, you were considered Canadian. But we had to take the league to court almost to prove that. It was right after J.R. Dillard did that. In the late 80s, I don't know if you remember him. He played at the Oklahoma State. His dad, Jim Dillard, had played with my dad at Ottawa. So after those two, they kind of relaxed the rules around that. So I got in as a Canadian, and that was significant because the ratio was quite a bit different back then. It was 13 Americans and 23 Canadians at that point. Now it's divided split 50-50. But back then, it was favored heavily toward the non-import spots, and I was competing with 22 other guys for spots instead of 12, which is huge. And so, again, I came through the back door. Nobody had really recruited me because they didn't know I was Canadian, right? And I wasn't getting recruited as an American because I was coming from a smaller conference. You really had to shine in those smaller conferences. In Division II, where I played at Northern Colorado, we played against North Dakota State, which was probably the only team anybody would really recognize other than North Dakota. It was a run-heavy conference. We didn't really see a lot of pass back then. But I mean, despite the fact that my dad had played in the CFL, I didn't really know anything about the CFL. I didn't know the rules. I didn't realize the field was so big. I remember the first time you ran gassers, which is you go down, back, down, back. We ran 4 of those and I was puking, And in the States, I could do that in my sleep. I would run it backwards and outrun most of the guys, but the premium up here is on speed. So everybody was fast. Everybody was faster than me. So I kind of had to figure out where I could find my niche. And then to top that all off, I played linebacker all my life. I had never played down in a down lineman position. After my first camp there, they moved me to defensive line. And so my chances of making a team were pretty slim. It was weird because myself and David Benefield were on that roster there, and we were both really considered long shots or dark horses to make the roster. We both ended up playing a really long time, but that was an interesting camp. We had a lot of really good football players on this team in 1991. And Stu Hill, Mike Walker, Brett the Toaster Williams, and it was a very difficult roster to crack. But I actually, even down to the cutdown day, I thought they were going to cut me, and I was getting ready to go back to Colorado, and they didn't call me. And then Ron Lancaster had to call my apartment and ask me where the hell I was. I said, "Well, I'm in my apartment." He goes, "Obviously, you're supposed to be at practice." I said, "I thought I was getting cut." He says, "If I don't call you, you're on the team." And I'm like, "Geez, what is this with you guys not talking to people, letting them make the team that way? That's not a way, communication's not their coach's forte, I guess." So ended up making the team and was pretty excited, and I played special teams, and that was the way I kind of came in. And as a couple of years in, we were coached with Ron Lancaster, who my dad had played with and against in the CFL, and he spoke very highly of Ron. Said that he was a good personality and that he was a fair guy, and he was a straight shooter. We ended up going to the Grey Cup in 1993 and winning it. That was probably the highlight of my career. Playing in the 96 Grey Cup was pretty exciting too, the Snow Bowl. Playing for 13 years, that was amazing. Not a lot of people get to say that. Playing all my career with one team. And being in a community-oriented team was really good, too, community-owned. And my dad gave me 2 pieces of advice when I moved to Edmonton. He said, do as much as you can in the community. He says, if you do that, then the community will take care of you. And he also said, don't worry about, don't get hung up on getting paid for stuff. He said, just do it. and then the rest will take care of it. And that's exactly what happened. You know, this is a it's a small town the size of a big city. Like, everybody knows everybody, so you got to be really careful when you play here because people talk. And I've been pretty fortunate. You know, I've been able to make a living out of it and stay here. And, you know, I've been here ever since 1990, man. I've been here for almost 30 years now. So it's a good place to live.
Jed Roberts joined us, longtime CFL player in Edmonton Eskimo, sharing his career and his life story with us today. It's absolutely fantastic, Jed. I've knew most of it. I didn't know everything, though. But I've got to ask you a bit of a serious question. I was going through, you know, the Google, looking at different things and all pictures of you when you were playing. I can't find any pictures where you're not flexing those massive arms. Was that something your trademark or just showed off the big pipes?
No, I was pretty lucky. I got my muscles from my mom. You know, people always joke because my dad was never known for speed, right? And I was pretty fast, but for a big guy, I was pretty known. I like to tell this story where, you know, I finished with 163 regular season special teams tackles. It's even higher if you put playoffs in, but for some reason, I don't figure that in. And I like to say that I hold the record in the CFL for guys over 100 or 250 pounds. It'll never be broken. So. Ever.
Like, I'm looking at your pictures, Jed. I couldn't imagine. Like, I like playing physical hockey, but seeing you, I would just be like, you know what? You got me. I would just take a knee. I would just take a knee and, like, forget it because you're so thick. And the speed, that's the problem. Like, you can hit heavy or chase a guy down. You must have been a real terror for guys on the other side of the ball.
It's funny that you say that because whenever I see the guys that I used to have battles with on special teams, that's what they all say. They're like, man, you're just – not only were you big, but you were fast, you know. And that was the thing that kind of used to piss them off because when I would be covering them, they couldn't really lose me, right, because I would always sort of hang around and then hunt them up downfield. And, you know, it was just fun. Like, the stuff that we did back then when we played, I mean, you know, Strud, you probably know this, is that, you know, a lot of that stuff's illegal now. Like, you can't take on a wedge anymore, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, just like now you have to wear a helmet in hockey, right? So, I mean, you can't do those things anymore, right? Like, so the game has completely evolved away from, like, the things that they sort of kept me around for are the things that don't even exist now. Like, I was the wedge buster. Like, they used to put me right next to the kicker. Sean Fleming and I were next to each other for 11 years. And he would kick the ball, and everybody formed their lanes off of me. And I was fast enough that I got down there first, you know, which is pretty terrifying when you think about it. And I used to either go over, under, or through the wedge, just depended. And they knew it was one of those three options, but I was like a pitcher. I just switch it up, you know. So if you got the wedge buster in there breaking up the wedge, it makes it very difficult for the opposing team to return a kickoff. And that's what I dream about now. Even that's really the only thing I miss. I don't miss the practices. I don't miss that. I just miss that big kit that you used to get, you know, when you run into the wedge. And you know, it's
Jed, you played with a lot of guys over the years. Who was maybe the one guy who was the most unpredictable as a teammate, as a player? Like, just, you know, kind of just like, this guy, like, I don't know if I could, he's just, I have to be on edge around him. Did you have just an unpredictable personality of a teammate?
You know, we didn't really have that around here, you know, because they were pretty mindful about keeping guys, like, they wanted the chemistry to be pretty good. Like, you have to keep in mind, I played for five different head coaches here, right?
Yeah.
And
what about Mishtub?
Yeah, you know, and I kind of thought you were leading up to that. I didn't think that it was unpredictable. I think you're just being PC. I mean, he was the biggest idiot we ever had here. I don't have any problem saying that because he was one of those guys that he was just about himself, you know. And we'd never had a guy like that here. They had always been really careful. And I think that was one, again, back to the head coaches we had, came in with Papa Farragelli, and then they had the dressing room thing where there was a big split between the African-American players and the Canadians, the white Canadians. And so they had to get rid of him, right, after the Grey Cup in 90 when we got blown out by Winnipeg. So they brought Ronnie in. He stabilized the dressing room. And then he left in 97 after the Western final loss against the Riders. They bring Kay Stevenson in, whose biggest claim to fame is wanting to put a sprinkler system into the field there where only we knew where the sprinkler heads were so that we could fill up our water bottles without the other team knowing it. That's how bad he was. And so we got rid of him after 1 year, and then they brought Don Matthews. Matthews was a guy that liked to line his squads with, like, mercenary types. And so for a couple of years there, we brought guys in from all over the place. And that was a really weird time because we weren't known for like switching in and out guys. And then Don left in the middle of the night, and then they brought Tom Higgins in to kind of settle the room down. And Hisham El-Mastoub was one of those guys that Don brought in, and he was a very talented. There's no questioning that he was talented. He was a center, played at the University of Arizona. He was part of that team that had the Desert Swarm defense with Teddy Bushi and some of those other guys. Donnie Salem, who I actually played against in high school, was on that team. You know, and he was just a weird guy. He was just a guy that nobody could really figure out. You know, and he would yell stuff that's inappropriate. The only guy that ever comes close, I think, was probably Jeff Braswell. But I liked Jeff Braswell. There was a method to his madness. But El-Mastoub, I honestly think that El-Mastoub had Tourette's, because he would just say the most, he would just say things. I couldn't even try to imitate him if I tried. I know that one time, like Gizmo Williams, we used to have this thing called the, we would do this like little stand-up routine, and guys would come in and then they would have to do their material, and it was the day before the game. And so they all asked me to come up with that. And I did this stand-up routine for 20 minutes where I just roasted El-Mastoub. And I think that was probably the one day when I felt probably more beloved than any other, because the guys were just so happy that somebody had finally just given El-Mastoub, you know, the goods. Because, I mean, even Doug Peterson wanted to kill him. You know, and El-Mastoub said something to him, and Doug Peterson almost died. I was hoping Doug would punch him, but he didn't. But
yeah, well, Doug Peterson was the only player I've ever remotely been intimidated by in my entire life of covering anybody. He was just a terrifying human being, and not in a bad way, because he was quite calm and he was very smart and he was very well read. But I just, back then when I first started covering the league, you were able to stand on the sidelines the entire game. It was unbelievable for a reporter. And I remember Doug Peterson in the scrum, he literally picked up two players, each with one hand, and he was like slamming them together. And I'm like, this guy is an absolute animal.
And then he'd be in the dressing room reading about string theory. You know, like, he was amazing. Smart, very intelligent guy. I keep in touch with him to this day. He's, that's the thing I miss about playing. You know, the personalities and the interesting things that happened. And, you know, someday if I ever get around to it, I'll write my memoirs and nobody will ever believe them. But,
Now, Jen, we want to take... We got to take one quick break. Do you got a few more minutes? Because I want to get to your caricatures. When I first started covering, there was a big whiteboard they would have. And I didn't know at first, probably the first 3 months, I didn't know who was drawing them. And people were like, no, that's Jed Roberts. And some of the funniest things I've ever seen. And nothing was offside for you on that. I want to get to those caricatures when we return with story time. Jed, some of your former teammates have texted in asking me to, can you explain what olive juice means?
Yeah, sure. I can tell you a quick story about that. We were playing against the Stampeders, and Blake Dermott came up to me and asked me, hey, can you give me something that I can use against Kenny Walker? You know, Kenny Walker played for the Denver Broncos. And he was a highly touted defensive lineman from the University of Nebraska, and he was completely deaf. So he didn't speak. He just used sign language. And so Blake was trying to figure out an edge or a way to get, to get underneath this guy's skin, because the guy couldn't hear him, so he just wanted to know if there was anything he could do, like sign language things or whatever. I think he assumed that all deaf guys are sign language guys, but they're not. But whatever, anyway. So, Blake, you know, this is one thing you can try. I said, at the end of a play, if you find yourself anywhere near him, just go grab his face backs, look him right in the eyes, and mouth these words. And I said, olive juice. And he said, what? And I said, try it, see what happens. So sure enough, first play from line of scrimmage, he runs over and finds Kenny Walker, grabs him by the face mask and says, olive juice. Kenny Walker hauls off, punches him in the face, and then he gets kicked out of the game. So Blake kind of staggers over to the side of the sideline there after the series is over, and he's like, what the hell was that all about? And I said, well, he just thinks you just told him you love him. And he goes, what? I said, olive juice, say it. He goes, olive juice. I said, it looks just like I love you.
Now I had heard a story when you were helping out the Edmonton Huskies. Did you not have binoculars and were reading the lips of the offensive coordinator?
I did that for the Eskimos when I was hurt in '98. Kay Stevenson put me in the dressing room and I was looking through binoculars. And people change their plays. No, I don't know how effective it was, but yeah, I can read lips from pretty far away. I like to chime in on Twitter sometimes when people are like, hey, what are these people saying? It drives me crazy when people go funny lip reading because I know what they're actually saying, so it doesn't really work with me. So people tag me in that. I'm like, quit tagging me in that, man. I know what they're already saying. It doesn't work with me.
Because so. I remember the Seinfeld episode. I'm sure you've seen it. When Kramer's girlfriend, and she's like, "I'll do it as the lip reader." So I always, because I remember talking to you, you were pretty good at it. I remember, I'm not mistaken, one night with Sean Fleming and Ed Hervey and yourself. And we were across the bar, and I'm like, "Hey, Jed, what are they saying?" And you were like pretty solid. I was like, because we went over there to ask these girls, like, that could have been like the greatest. You could have sent a guy over, talk to a girl, then come back. Yeah, what are they talking about me? Like, you must have used that skill at some point.
Listen, anytime I'm feeling bad about my life, I usually go and sit down and find a seat at a Tim Hortons and just eavesdrop on five different conversations. You'd be shocked at what people talk about in broad daylight. It's amazing.
Jed, I've read that it's hard to read someone's lips if they have a big mustache. Can you confirm or deny that?
Very difficult, yeah. Especially, and a beard. It makes it even harder when they have a beard. It's very difficult. But it also depends on, some people like to talk through their teeth, and that drives me crazy. I've had lots of teachers during my lifetime, and they just figured I didn't like them. I'm like, dude, you need to talk. Like, you need to actually open your mouth when you say things. Everybody talks differently, right? Some people like to... And when people have thin lips, that drives me crazy. You know, I'm like, you're wasting my time right now. I can't even talk to you. Like, I need an interpreter. Jesus, where's the girl in the black turtleneck with the sign language in the lower left-hand corner? Because that would work better than what you're doing for me right now. This is ridiculous.
Jed Roberts joins us in story time. What was the biggest challenge? Because you mentioned when you first came to Edmonton, you only used one hearing aid. Then you went to two. But even with the hearing aids, when you were playing, what was the biggest challenge being hearing impaired as a professional athlete, even with the hearing aids?
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Like, when I came in, and a lot of people don't know this, but I never wore my hearing aids while I was playing, ever, until I came to Edmonton.
What?
And when I came to Edmonton, I saw an audiologist over at Metalife named Michael Shields, and he runs Accent Hearing Associates. And he's been my audiologist for years. I sent Michelle Bourgeot, who was also hearing impaired, and I also sent Danny Kepley over there to see him when he lost part of his hearing when he had that cyst explode in his stomach and he got an infection or whatever. So he did a lot of good work with us, but he told me, he said, you don't know how much you're missing. And then I finally kind of settled down and listened to him, and I was like, holy smokes, you're right. So I wore one hearing aid when I was playing, but I still can't hear anything. Like, I can only sort of see. And so what a lot of people don't realize is they have this thing in football called audibles. It's more prevalent on offense when quarterbacks, like, barking out their signals, and people say, well, they're just yelling random stuff. And they're not, actually. Sometimes they'll change the play, and everybody has to be able to hear that. And you have to be able to hear that when 50,000 people are screaming. And you also have to be able to hear it when the band's playing and all this other stuff, right? So it's chaotic. And I can't hear it. So on defense, when we would have audibles, I had to know on every play what the variables were and why we would change them. And I had to get in with the linebackers. I started doing that with Danny Bass in 1991. My big come to Jesus moment with that was when I went over to his house for a linebacker gathering, and I saw all the beta tapes that he had piled up in his office study, and he was just sitting there, you know, fast forward, rewinding, fast forward, going over every play like 30 times. And I had to get into the room with him and Willie Pless, and I had to ask those questions, like, when do we change these? So I had to know what everybody on the defense was doing, what the corners adjustment was, what the front seven, like all those adjustments I had to know in my head. And so then I had to make the same call that the linebacker was making in my head. So that was the biggest thing to overcome. And I think that's what a lot of people don't understand. And that's something that I've only started sharing that in the last 3 or 4 years, because I really wanted to distance myself from the hearing impaired thing. You know, it wasn't something I really wanted to particularly be known for. But as I get older, I've come to peace with it. You know, it's not something that I really get too hung up on. It's actually something I've sort of kind of come around to be sort of proud of, you know. And when you think of it in those terms, it really is remarkable, you know, because I always had to be on the same page with the linebacker, and I had to do it out of a 3-point stance, you know, and I couldn't see what was going on behind me. So I had to really see the motion between the legs of the lineman, and really had to use my peripheral vision. And it was, Sometimes I look back and I'm wondering how the hell I ever pulled all of that stuff off. But I fooled them for 13 years, so, you know, I'm still here.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Chad, it seems to me like you were obviously physically very gifted, and we've talked about the speed and the size, but you know, I don't know if this is a fair statement, but to compensate for the lack of hearing, you had to be maybe the smartest player on the field, and that was probably maybe your best attribute you had of the three.
Well, you know what? Like, I used to gravitate toward the guys who were a little bit brighter, you know, and Doug and I used to hang out quite a bit. His locker was next to mine, and we used to have some really interesting conversations. Ed Hervey and I were really tight because Ed is an interesting guy, and Ed doesn't care what you think about him, and that was one of the things that I really appreciated about him. And he's incredibly smart, and he was one of those guys that was thinking, like, way ahead of, like, he wasn't in the current moment. He was already thinking about what was going to happen. And so those were the guys that I naturally gravitated toward. And, you know, and the discourse that used to happen around us was very, like, you had to be really quick to keep up with it. And so that was, there was a lip reading for me. I had to basically focus in on, because things would happen in fast, right? So, and one of the things I used to do to kind of pass the time was I'd look around the room and see the different personalities and just get up on the whiteboard and start, you know, I would make themes. Like, I remember when Tavis was like, do me. And I'm like, why do you want me to draw you so bad? He says, I just want you to put me up on the board, man. Cause that was like the big thing back then. So I said, Tavis, I'm going to put you up on the board, but I don't want you to get mad. He's like, no, I don't care, man. Just put it. So I put him up there, and he had like 17 rings in his neck, and he was standing on one foot, leaning up against the spear. And I said, is this okay? And he's like, this is awesome. And he's like taking pictures of it. And Chris Hardy asked me to do him. I said, dude, I'm going to make you into a bar star. And he goes, I don't care. Just put me up there. So I had him up there in a Speedo with flies flying around his crotch and, you know, Club Malibu Man 2001. I did Johnny Ackley, who was very diminutive. He was about 5'4". I had him riding a big wheel with the big hoop earrings, you know, behind it with the streamers coming out the handlebars. I did a Christmas card from Donnie Wilson.
Yes.
Benny Goods and Gizmo Williams. And Benny Goods had food on his face, and he had his shirt riding up over his belly button. And he was like a little kid. Him and Donnie Wilson was the dad with his long arms around both him and Giz. And Giz looked like a complete gremlin. And, yeah, you know, I had a lot of really good material because we had a lot of ugly guys. So.
And you drew those caricatures. That was kind of, and for people who don't know the old layout of the Eskimo room, the offensive guys were kind of on one half, and then the room opened up a bit, and then the defensive guys and the special teams guys were on the other side. But like Gizmo Williams was pretty much one of your regulars that you would draw constantly about.
Yeah, he was. You know, and I used to prank him a lot, and that's not something I think people really knew. There was one time, and Gizmo was really well known for being a bit of a troubadour, you know, he was a Rolling Stone, if you will. And one time I went into the Eskimo's office. This is a product of a bygone area, but I grabbed the stationery with the letterhead, right? And I typed up a letter saying, Mr. Williams, you know, in the interest of avoiding possible complications, we would really like it if you would let us know the locations around the stadium of your love interests, so just to avoid potential embarrassing conflicts of interest. And I made it look really official, and I forged Hughes Campbell's signature on it, and I put it in his locker, and he read it, and then he looked around, and then he read it again, and then he stormed out of there, and he was going on his way down to the head office to ream Hugh out. I had to intercept him and say, dude, it was a joke, man. It was me. And he goes, oh, you wanted to kill me.
Giz was one of the strongest teammates you ever had, I bet.
Yeah, he was. He was, you know what, like people – he didn't really belong here. Like, I don't know what he was doing up here. Like, he was a world-class talent, you know, and he was long jumping 26 feet in high school. Like, he could do things. He does things now that are insane. Like, he can do triple flips on triple three and a half somersaults. And he was just a freak. And I just loved him. And he was very quick. His brain was very, like, for a guy who comes across sometimes as being uneducated, he was probably the smartest guy I ever played with. Like, his mind was so fast. Like you would try to burn him and he would come right back on you. And him and I used to go back and forth quite a bit. I don't know why, but for some reason him and I, like, he could never quite get me. We would always go at it. You know, I saw Benny go at him, and he used to call Donnie Wilson his horse, you know, because he was as ugly as a horse. And he used to say, Benny, it looked like somebody, looks like you put a pack of lady fingers in your mouth and they exploded, because he only had, like, you know, his teeth were spaced really far apart. And he would come up with the funniest things at the most inopportune time. You know, we used to go around speaking, and he used to do some pretty funny stuff, you know, and I those are the things that put a smile on my face when I look back at my career. You know, it wasn't so much about the playing, it was the personality, really.
Oh, yeah, there was definitely a lot of them over the years. Jed, that has been a fantastic hour, man. I was going to keep you for a few segments, but it was just too good not to. We're going to have you back on again really soon. Always appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate you calling me in. It was nice. It's a beautiful day out. You know, it could always be worse, you know. Like, I laugh at this a little bit because my grandparents were born in 1912, survived the swine flu pandemic, World War I, World War II. And we're panicking a little bit about our modems getting overloaded. I mean, yeah, this pandemic is pretty serious, but you know what? Keep it in perspective. It could always be worse.
Yeah, I love it, buddy.
Very well said, Jed. Thanks, my man.
Hey, thank you very much. I'll talk to you soon.